Okay, this is the final evening of the retreat, and I did promise yesterday that I'll talk about the teaching of dependent origination, which is one of the most profound and deep teachings which the Buddha gave. So I'm going to test you, and I'm going to also test myself, because not only is it a deep teaching, but it's also a difficult one to express. However, to know the profundity of dependent origination, you just need to understand the Buddha said that whoever sees dependent origination sees the Dhamma. Whoever sees the Dhamma sees dependent origination. Also saying whoever sees the Dhamma sees the Buddha. Whoever sees the Buddha sees the Dhamma. So this is actually one of the hearts of the Buddha's teachings. And the full understanding, it's all its breadth, of paticca-samuppada, or dependent origination, arises with the attainment of stream entry. And this is one of the features of the attainment of the first enlightenment experience, of understanding the conditionality, the empty process, that understanding the causes which arouse and maintain and eventually allow this process to cease. So this is like dependent origination, and it links up to the talk which I gave last night about anatta, about non-self, and the investigation which leads up to the discovery that that which one took to be a self is an illusion, that one eradicates, abandons, lets go of the illusion of self, and one gains these beautiful consequences of liberation, freedom, peace, cessation. However, I did mention that one of the places where the illusion of self hangs out, where it lingers in will, choice, that which seems to be the controller of this body and mind. And the other place I said where it hangs out, its headquarters, is that which is conscious, that which perceives, thinks, knows, etc. Those are the two main places where the person can take to be an ego, a self, a me and mine. And I did mention, especially about this very interesting faculty of the mind called will or choice, that it has its causes. And the dependent origination, part of dependent origination, illuminates the causes of will. Now, it's not who chooses, but how does choice come about? What's its cause? What supports it? And what's its consequence? But that will come out in the talk, hopefully, as I go along. But in order to make the talk coherent, I'm going to start at the very beginning of dependent origination, and just to point out again that the Buddha mentioned in many places that the main, if you like, bogeymen or bogeywomen or bogey, whatever you call them, the main problems of our existence are twofold, and that's ignorance or delusion and craving. So that avijja, the delusion or ignorance, and craving, the dhanha, these are the two things which the Buddha pointed out cause all the problems. Blinded by ignorance and led by craving, the person works for his own pain and discomfort and the pain and discomfort of others, and wanders around endlessly this realm of samsara. And so it's blinded by ignorance and led by craving. And the dependent origination, you can regard it as having these two starting points, either from regarding it as starting from ignorance or delusion, or starting from craving, from dhanha. The root cause, though, will always be the delusion, as I pointed out a few days ago. But it's actually the delusion which is the creator of craving. And I'll bring this into the talk as I go along. Because we mistake what is happiness. Because we mistake what is suffering to be happiness, we crave for that. We go after it, we search for it. And because we take that which is impermanent to be permanent, again, we search and crave for it. And because we take that which is non-self to be self, that we go about the craving in the first place, thinking that it's coming from us, that we can control, that we can manipulate, that we can make and possess. And so that these are the ways which delusion creates craving. And the craving always finds its source in the illusion of a soul, a self, a me or mine. However, there is no beginning can be discerned of this illusion. All that one knows is that it's fed and nourished by the five hindrances. And as long as those five hindrances are strong and always present, it will just keep on supporting this illusory nature of existence, making it a mirage and thinking it to be something which it isn't. And I also mentioned with the simile of a mirage, the mirage, there's an aspect of the mirage which has reality. The light is actually reaching your eyes from the mirage. You're not imagining the mirage. The sight actually occurs. There is something happening there. The reason why it's illusory is because one is taking that sensory impingement to be something which it isn't. You think it's a body of water when it's just a reflection from the sky. So it is something there. When I'm talking about illusion, you're not saying that everything is void, that there is nothing there. What you are saying is that there is something there, but we mistake it. We perceive it, we think about it, or we view it to be something other than it truly is. Now this is the starting point of dependent origination in the Buddha's teaching. He didn't say how ignorance first started. That's, he said, would send a person crazy trying to work it out. It just goes back too far, too complex, the chain. But starting at ignorance and starting at delusion, which you may not be able to see fully, but at least you can get an idea of, a rational, intellectual idea of. And sometimes you can see illusion happening after it's occurred. You can see that illusion has happened and you've mistaken what was for something else. So instead of looking at the root cause, the beginning of illusion, one can see that it just it is. It's there. And in dependent origination, the Buddha pointed out in this part of the cycle of 12 links, that because of that illusion, that delusion, that one makes karma, that one does actions of body, speech and mind which produce rebirth in the future. This is like rebirth producing karma because of delusion, because one thinks that a certain type of being, a certain level of existence, a certain status, a certain experience will provide you with happiness. But because of not understanding the law of dukkha, that one actually aspires towards certain forms of existence. For those of you who have fantasies, you know, sometimes during your meditation, sometimes at night in your sleep or whatever, why do you dream that way? Why is that has a sense of joy and happiness there? It is because that somewhere one thinks that this type of existence, that being with that person in that place, being rich, being famous or whatever, is going to be happy, is going to cause you the fulfillment and contentment. Why is it, I've often noticed, why is it that people spend so much time watching the soap operas on the television? Because it's the fantasy realm there where they can live and they feel that this is delightful, this is happy, this is exciting, this is beautiful. And that because of the delusion, one takes what is basically to be suffering to be happiness, to be fun, to be exciting, to be worthwhile, to be fulfilling, to be enriching. I've heard that many people in our modern times think the purpose of life is to have as many enriching experiences as possible before you die. And taking all these enriching experiences to be joy, fun, worthwhile, happiness. And because of that, they will go to those places. They'll pay the money to go on those trips overseas. And this is the same process which is called a rebirth producing karma. It's based on delusion, it's caused by delusion. And this is the main reason why people get reborn. Because they want to get reborn. Because they make this momentum during their life. All that they didn't attain in this life, they decide to try and get it for the next life. All the imperfections in this life are not quite right. One thinks, well, next time I can get it right. How many people, honestly, truly, if someone could wave a magic wand and say, right, I can send you back to when you were young, fit and healthy, 18, 19, strong, pretty, keep all your wisdom, which you've all your learning, and you can start all over again. And you think, well, if I can have that all over again, I won't make so many mistakes next time. I can make it so much better. Maybe I can fulfill my dreams, my hopes, my aspirations next time. This is all like rebirth producing karma. By body, speech and mind, we create the causes for the mind to seek a new birth and a new lifetime. We can aspire to heaven realms, we can aspire to jhana realms, we can aspire. Sometimes I remember even someone saying when they saw the cats in the monastery, oh, that's a really beautiful life, being born as a cat in a monastery. They don't need to meditate, they just sleep all day and they get fed two or three times a day, much more than the monks get fed. They don't have to do anything. When the monks are working, the cats are just playing around or snoozing. You know, what a beautiful life to aspire to be a cat in a monastery. And however, sort of, that is the rebirth producing karma. If you want that bad enough, then it would happen. So be careful. Sometimes one doesn't understand the power of those aspirations and those thoughts, the rebirth producing karma. And it's all based on illusion, thinking that, you know, that could be a happy state. But if one would look only a little bit closer, one would find it's not a happy state at all. And many people in the world will aspire to be rich and famous. Oh, if only I could do, you know, do what those people did. To have all that adulation, people clapping and cheering you. And that is the sort of rebirth-producing karma also. And if one has the supporting conditions, that will happen. When the rebirth takes place, with the rebirth comes all of the sensory apparatus. The rebirth linking consciousness produces the sensory objects, the nama-rupa, the sensory apparatus of the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and the mind. You know, the six sense bases. And because you've got the sensory apparatus, you've got the sense objects, you've got the consciousness, you will have the meeting of them all becomes contact, and contact produces the Vedana, the feeling as characterized by pleasant, unpleasant or neutral, which is there with all sensory experience. So this part of the dependent origination is just saying that because of delusion, one aspires and makes these karma, these rebirth producing karma which gives rise to the new consciousness and all of the sensory apparatus and all of the sensory experience, including happiness and suffering in the next life. And just stop there for the moment, because this is like the first half of dependent origination. And if one looks a bit closer at the result, the Vedana, this Vedana, what you're producing, is not particular sensations, that you're going to get particularly unpleasant or pleasant sensations. What it's saying is that if you get reborn, you have to accept that sometimes it's going to be dukkha vedana, the unpleasant sensation, sometimes it's going to be pleasant. You're going to create the potential for both. As I pointed out earlier talks, that dukkha and sukha, the happiness and the pain, the joy and the despair, that these are inextricably linked together. They are pairs which cannot be divided, which cannot be separated. If you have sensation, feeling, you're going to have both happiness and suffering. Inextricable. So if you are going to take on a new birth, you have to take on that half of that experience consequent on birth, which is suffering. It's as Ajahn Chah used to say, that if you join the army, you open the possibility up to get shot, to get wounded, to get maimed. That's what happens if you join an army. And if you join an army and then it happens that you're the one who gets shot, captured, tortured, or whatever, he said, why do you complain? That's par for the course. That's what happens. You should have known that when you first joined the army. He's saying, if you get reborn, you should know that this is what happens. You get the disappointments, the pains, you get the traumas, you get the mosquitoes biting you, you get the backaches, you get the memories from the past. This is what happens when you get born. You get the pains of old age, sicknesses. If you have a body, it's open to being sick, to being hurt, to being crushed, to being stabbed, to being all sorts of stuff. That potential is there for unpleasant as well as pleasant sensations. Now, the illusion comes along at this point again, when we have all of these. This is, you know, one part of the cycle of dependent origination, from the delusion creating the new birth and having the consequent happiness and suffering. In all realms, there has to be some happiness and suffering. In the heaven realms, it's all that happiness you've had for, what was I saying, 84,000 eons. The suffering comes about when you have to leave 84,000 eons of pleasure. The more pleasure you've experienced, usually, the more suffering it is leaving it. And that's why that pleasure is always borrowed. It's paid back by suffering. The more happy you live in this life now, that when those conditions are taken away and the happiness is removed, the worse one suffers. The higher one goes, the further one falls. The more the pendulum swings to the left, when it's let go, when the causes disappear, the further it swings to the right. So there is even suffering, and sometimes great suffering, at the end of the life of the heavenly beings. So there's no realm, the Buddha said, which is beyond suffering. And each has its own type. And as such, the Buddha said that this is the consequence of being reborn. Now, when these sensations and feelings arise in our lives because of ignorance, again, that the combination of the experience of pleasure and pain plus delusion causes craving. It's a craving which the delusion that we're in control of this, that we can manipulate this, that we are actually doing the choosing, actually causes us to try and maximize the pleasurable feelings and eradicate the unpleasant feelings. And eradicating the unpleasant feelings, this is just a simplification of sometimes very complex processes. Whenever something comes up which we don't approve of, we don't like, we find hard to bear, we try and eradicate it, get rid of it, overcome it, escape from it, go somewhere where it's not. And you can find, or you can see, that half of life is trying to overcome, eradicate painful sensations, dukkha vedana, whether that's in the mind or in the body. And that can come in very complicated results, consequences. It sometimes gets anger, in ill will, and sometimes it becomes depression and self-hatred, suicide even. Always trying to overcome the unpleasant sensations of any of the six senses. Unpleasant sights, sounds, taste, touches, so taste, smells, especially unpleasant feelings in the body. This is by far the most difficult of the five senses to deal with, because an unpleasant sight you can turn away from, but an unpleasant bodily feeling, you have to go to doctors, to hospitals, to homeopaths, to psychic Reiki healers or whatever, and it still doesn't go away. That's why the big problem with human existence is the physical feelings of the fifth sense base. And this creates all sorts of busyness, work, confusion, complexities in our life. And much of life is taken up just with this. The search to escape from, eradicate, overcome the unpleasant feelings. The other part of our life is spent in amassing, protecting, increasing the pleasant feelings. Whether that's finding the perfect partner to have sexual relations with, and when they get old, changing them so you can have, you know, continue the newness and freshness of pleasure. Because you always find there's the law of decreasing returns with sensory pleasures. That when you first take something, it's delicious. The next time, it's still reasonably delicious, but not as fresh as the first time. As the times go by, it gets boring. I've often noticed that people tell me that the TV films are full of sex and violence. About, what, four or five, no, longer ago than that, six, 7 years ago, I went to visit my mother in England and sat with her while she watched one of these police detective things on the television. And it was only half an hour long. And I was just amazed, for not having seen television for years, just how many people died in half an hour. And I think, is it called Professionals or something like that? One of those sort of secret service in England, you know, fighting all sorts of terrorists. And I remembered that before I became a monk, that the only sort of TV cops and robbers film I could remember was a program called Dixon of Dot Green. And you know, there's many, many episodes before you ever saw someone die. There's hardly any violence there at all. And I sort of started to notice, why is there the increase of violence, the increase in sexuality in the media? It's because if you show Dixon of Dot Green today, people just fall asleep. It used to be interesting and exciting. 25 years ago, but nowadays, because of the law of decreasing returns, it needs to be ever more stimulating, ever more exciting. What worked to produce pleasure yesterday is dull today, then is really boring tomorrow. And this is like the sensuality. This is what happens, and tired and sick happiness therein becomes like a lost cause. However, because of illusion, because we think that the reason we failed before is not anything wrong with existence, The reason we fail to find satisfaction before we think is because maybe we weren't clever enough, smart enough, we didn't know all the tricks, so we're going to try and do better next time. To exert more control, be more smart. This is the illusion of thinking that we can do much better next time. This is called craving. And it's a craving which is based on the pleasurable and painful feelings with the illusion of the self, which creates this craving which becomes another source of the problem. The craving produces the thirst, which is the activity of the mind to try and manipulate, to control, to gain more happiness and less pain. Not only is it just the craving for happiness and the craving to avoid pain which is the problem here, but because of the illusion of the self, there's also the craving to be, the craving to exist, which is another very powerful force that we really want to be. We'd rather experience pleasure or pain than to experience nothing at all. And the idea of, which I mentioned earlier, about cessation, about just not being, not existing, to the people who don't understand not self, seems to be a pointless exercise. How can that be pleasurable? Because of the craving to be. It's called bhava dhanha, and this is a deep-seated root of this process going on. The other type of craving I'll mention, which is very important but more refined and difficult to see, is called vibhava dhanha, which is like the suicidal craving, a craving which seeks to destroy oneself. It's a craving which actually assumes there is someone there in the first place which you want to destroy. And it creates this more karma, more rebirth. You can't get rid of yourself that easy. The way to understand the problem is not by destruction, it's by wisdom, by letting go rather than blowing up. But these cravings are born on misunderstanding the Vedana, the sensations which arise and fall, instead of seeing them as just natural occurrences of the universe, just inextricable parts of conscious experience that we crave, we try and control them, we try and manipulate them, and that gives rise to the attachments. That which we assume is going to provide us safety, security, away from painful experiences, we attach to. That which we think will provide us with happiness, with bliss, with joy, that's what we attach to. And through that attachment, through that craving, through that attachment, we are again building up the process of keeping this process going over into new lives. This process of going over into new lives is called by the Buddha the process of existence, bhava. Also the process of that becoming. From craving and attachment, again, we're building up the karma which produces rebirth. As we crave for a particular type of happiness, as we attach to that which we think provides that happiness, as we crave to avoid pain and attach to that which prevents that pain from arising, so we think, so we build up the momentum. And if we don't achieve the end of that craving, we don't achieve the satisfaction, which we're looking for, the safety, the provision of the perfect happiness and the eradication of all pain, mental and physical, in this life. That force, that momentum of craving and attachment will produce the new rebirth. This process of bhava, of existence. The Buddha said that, he gave that simile from the agricultural world of his time. He said that like consciousness is like the seed, and the karma is the field, and the craving is the sap. And for beings who are blinded by ignorance, led by craving, that consciousness finds roots in that karmic field. Fed by craving, it grows to fruition. Rebirth takes place in that realm. And from rebirth, the Buddha said, that we get all this suffering. So in this dependent origination, we've got like two parts which span this process of rebirth. Looking at the problem, first of all, from starting from delusion, and the other one starting from craving. And to put them back together, we've got delusion creating craving because of the illusion of a self. The self has to do something. It wants to control and manipulate to amass pleasure to avoid pain. It's basic function. And because of that, that all this activity is karma. You know, trying to do business in the world, trying to do business in the mind, trying to gain pleasure, avoid pain, not understanding what these pleasure and pain are and what its source is, and thinking that we can change the nature and just have one pleasure without the other pain. And that produces, because of that karma, that is looked at in another way as craving and attachment. Craving and attachment is karma. Karma is craving and attachment. When we crave, when we attach, that's doing karma. I'll mention that in a moment, when the Buddha said that karma is will, chetana. And I'll mention in a moment that you can identify chetana, will, as being caused by craving and attachment. This is where it originates from. And I'll come back to this in a moment. But the craving and the attachment, which is producing the will, which makes karma, that produces the process of the mind going out, searching for a place to fulfill its aspirations. Searching for a place where it can satisfy its cravings and attachments. It builds the future. It builds rebirth. And the Buddha said, once you get the rebirth, then you have all these sense faculties again, which come along with rebirth, the sense objects, and you get this vedana back again. You actually don't solve the problem, but you just create more problems. And you have more sukha dukkha, more happiness and suffering to deal with. So he said, this is the problem of rebirth. That craving seeks, as I was mentioning the other day, craving, like, is suicidal. It seeks to eliminate itself and find satisfaction and peace thereby. But instead of stopping the cycle, the craving does the opposite. By searching for fulfillment outside, it just creates more craving, and more craving, and more birth, and more suffering. Because the Buddha said that once is birth is suffering, because of having sensations, because of having perception, because of having thought, consciousness. Another place the Buddha said, whatever you experience, that you will have this quality of vedana there. It's either pleasant, unpleasant, or somewhere in between. You'll perceive it. You'll think about it. And very often you'll go off on a tangent about it. But certainly it's conscious experience. and conscious experience, the Buddha said, is a pain. The more you can tranquilize it and settle it down, the more soft and sublime conscious experience is, the more you regard it as happiness. The more silent, the more bliss. And seeing that much gives the meditator the clue, the insight, that maybe if I silence it altogether, it can be the highest bliss. And that's true. That's the way out of samsara. Now, to go back to spotlighting part of this dependent origination, which I was mentioning earlier, which I said I would talk about last night, it's, you know, how this will arises. You know, this decision to do. And if you have enough samadhi, the ability to sustain your attention on something, you'll find that the mindfulness is very strong and refined. And you may even be able to apply that mindfulness, what appears as clarity of mind, to the function of mind, which is will. You can see intentions arising. And you can see the intention arising, the first movement of the mind, giving rise to inner speech, the orders and the plans which we make, giving rise very often to the outer speech. As one thinks, so one acts and speaks. And you can start to see this whole process of that which we call activity, starting with the movement of the mind towards its aim, its purpose, and culminating in the words coming out, the actions coming out, moving toward fulfilling, you know, your purpose. But all starting from this little intention, this what appears to many people to be the self turning the switch, driving the steering wheel, putting the foot down on the accelerator to speed up, or the put on the brakes to slow down, as if there is a being in here moving the pedals with its hands on the wheel. That is what we call like intention. Now, where is that coming from? What is a cause if it's not a self, a being in there? You should be able to see, if your mindfulness is strong and if your wisdom is sharp, that it's just this craving is creating that which we which appears to us as will, as choice. You start to see that behind that will, what is motivating it, what is generating it, is this thing we call craving. The thirst for fulfillment, for happiness, for pleasure. The craving, which is wants to avoid pain. Or the craving just to be. Sometimes we're sitting here very, very peaceful and quiet, and the delusion says we're not being enough. We're not doing enough. And thoughts come just for the sake of noticing you're still there. Just for, to be, to exist. That craving to be is very strong, as in like Hamlet's soliloquy. To be or not to be, that's the problem. The Buddha said, no, it's more than that. To enjoy, to be or not to be, that is the illusion, not the problem. Because the solution is, there's no being in the first place. The word be should be struck out. There's the illusory premise to that dilemma of Hamlet. If you can notice that craving is the source of the intentions, the will, the choice, and not a being, it's not you who does this, it's a craving. And that craving has its source as well. And that craving, you can start to see, is that conditioned, habitual response, which we call delusion. You can start to see the cause of that craving into that vicious cycle, which I call the perversions or distortions in an earlier talk, that when you have a particular view, that will create the perceptions, which will create the thoughts, which will create the craving. With the views, perception, sorry, the perceptions, thought and views, there you find the craving, the source of craving. If you view something in a particular way, you perceive it in a particular way, you think about it in a particular way, it's all building and reinforcing one another, you'll find that is the source of the craving. It's the ignorance, the delusion, which creates the craving, which creates the will, which creates the mind going out, searching for satisfaction in places where it never will find it, but always with the hope that next time it will be satisfied. Always next time, next lifetime, next moment, next hour, whatever. And that hope, that search, keeps the wheel of samsara going. So it's seen that the will, that which chooses, is not coming from a sense of self. But one can trace the causality back in this fashion, that chetana will is caused by craving, and craving is caused by this cycle of perception, thought and view, going round and round. Because it goes round and round, a circular, it has no beginning, no apparent end. So you can't trace the cycle further back than this. And that's why the Buddha said that you cannot find the beginning of intention. So you cannot find the beginning of avijja or delusion, ignorance, because the delusion is explained as that cycle of perception, thoughts and view. Which one comes first? You don't know where you got it wrong to start with, but once it's wrong, it just keeps on going. The interesting thing is how on earth this can stop. Family and went away from home, that he was partying and drinking and having a good time the first work time away from his parents. And just as his tape has gone on to reverse, there is like a reversal of this process. Good time. The reversal of the process, the unwinding of delusion. And this is actually shown in one of the suttas which the Buddha taught, which actually has the name transcendental dependent origination. It's a very important and interesting to see that just as the problem, the going round and round in circles called samsara, searching for happiness and finding disappointment, never being really fulfilled, always feeling empty and disappointed in the long run, having moments where one thinks one has got the goal and then finding it slipping away from you, never finding a real place to roost and rest. But the Buddha said that there is a way out of this, and just as the round of samsara is selfless, it's one cause leading to a result which leads to another cause and even leading to another result, the vicious cycles as we call them in English, just the same way there's no self in here, just the same way that the process to get out of this mess also, it doesn't require a self. You don't decide that, okay, I've had enough, now I'm going to get out of this. That, if it actually appears like that to you, that's what we call the vibhavadanha, which the Buddha was talking about. And that doesn't cause the ending of the cycle. Vibhavadanha, the craving for non-existence. Because it's coming from a wrong place, the illusion of a self. The way it comes about, the Buddha said, is that the more one experiences dissatisfaction, the more one understands dukkha, the more it gives rise to actually faith and confidence in the Buddha's teaching. Obviously it assumes that one knows those Buddhist teachings, or one has heard about them, or has come across them, that they exist for you. But there is the Buddha's teachings eventually in the world. Even the Buddha himself heard those teachings from previous Buddhas. So those Buddhist teachings are there. Where they started from, we don't know, because there's been, according to the cosmology, there's been innumerable Buddhas in the past universal cycles, and there will be innumerable Buddhas in the future, in future cycles. So the Buddha's teachings sometimes disappear, but only for a short while, and there are some beings in the world who remember them. So they never really disappear from the cosmos. They only disappear from, say, you know, one particular realm of existence, the human realm on Earth, maybe for a while. But because of the experience of suffering, that we get like a confidence in the Buddha's teachings, which is just pointing just to this. It gives a sense that this may be a path out. And the more that one investigates dukkha, suffering, the more one starts to get a understanding, even an intellectual understanding, a faith understanding at this time, of the Buddha's teachings. Because of dukkha, because of suffering, even one comes to a meditation retreat, thinking that this is a way out of suffering. But by training the mind, I may get some peace. I may get some happiness. Or by seeing sort of a happy teacher, you think, well, that's what I want as well. If Ajahn Chah says you have to meditate, that's what I'm going to do. So it gives the faith, the confidence. And that confidence causes the practice of the path. Because you have the confidence, you decide to do something about the path. Not just to chant it or to study it, but actually to practice it. It gives rise to the joy, which gives rise to the interest, which gives rise to, once the joy and interest comes, is a sense of tranquility. That, you know, you have an area which you really want to work on, and you don't get so diverse. The doubt, which causes the diversity of the mind, looking here, looking there, and you get a degree of tranquility. In particular, that when faith gets very strong, it brings up happiness and interest, especially in the way of meditation. It starts to bring up that tranquility of body and mind, which brings up the ease, the happiness, which I mentioned is the source of samadhi. It causes samadhi to occur. This tranquility of the mind, which sustains its attention. Sustains its attention on the mind, and thereby sees its nature, sees things as they truly are. In particular, it doesn't see things, it sees relationships. The relationship of cause and result. By the investigation of seeing the mind, vipassana, don't think that vipassana is seeing objects. Look upon it as seeing relationships. Cause and result relationships. If something has happened in the mind, look for its cause. Looking, the work of the mind which goes back to the source is called yonisamanasikara, which I've been mentioning. The work of the mind which goes back to its source. The result, look for its cause. The why, where did this come from? And you start to see that every result has its cause. You start to see especially the cause of suffering, craving, delusion. Once you start to see this and see it very, very clearly, it gives rise into this cause and result sequence of transcendental dependent origination, or you might call it transcendental dependent cessation. Because once you see the truth of craving, the truth that craving is being generated by sensory experience and misunderstanding it, there comes a realization of the painful experience of vedana, perception, consciousness, understanding that tranquility is preferable, that silence is better than noise, that cessation is more happy than activity. And it gives rise to this interesting quality which is called nibbida. And nibbida is this force which arises in the practitioner, which becomes disgusted, repelled, distasteful towards certain activities of consciousness. That nibbida, that distaste, that repulsion, first goes towards the world of the five senses. And it pushes one into enjoying the experiences of jhana. It pushes one away from the first jhana, so one can enjoy the second. And it pushes one eventually from all perception and consciousness into cessation. And there, one experiences, or after, one experiences the viraga, the dispassion, not to objects of the world. Sometimes dispassion, we think, is just dispassionate towards my car, my wife, my husband, my kids, my possessions. It's not just dispassionate to objects. It's not even dispassionate just towards your body. It's dispassionate also towards the objects which you call your mind. Dispassionate towards vedana, the pleasant, unpleasant, you become dispassionate towards it. Detached. Pleasant, unpleasant, you just watch it rise, watch it pass away. Not even enduring it in a manner of enduring by pressing the tongue against the palate or clenching one's teeth. But because one is dispassionate towards it, it does not affect the mind. Pain or pleasure, one realizes it's just the night and day, the heat and the cold. The painful and pleasant experiences of the world no longer move you. You're dispassionate. And when there's dispassion, there arises the experience of release. Release from the burden of having to control, of having to do. Tomorrow when I leave here, I'll be abbot of a monastery again. For the last 9 days, I haven't had a monastery. That's freedom. Freedom from having to control. And you've all had your freedoms. What was it like to be free of having to order, control, responsibilities, duties? What a relief. When one can let go of all of that control through that dispassion, it brings up the freedom to vimutti and the knowledge of freedom. And the full freedom is known as enlightenment. You are free from craving, free from being blown around by the painful and unpleasant experiences, and being blown around by the pleasant, enjoyable experiences. As it were, you take these in your stride with a feeling of serenity, a feeling of understanding that if you have eyes, you'll see pleasant and unpleasant sights. If you have a body, you'll feel pain and pleasure. And searching for one and trying to get rid of the other is basically pretty much a waste of time. This gives rise to the experience of enlightenment, the freeing of the mind from craving, the freeing of attachment. And that craving and attachment is the same as the rebirth producing karma. The rebirth producing karma being destroyed means there's no rebirth. The cycle has been ended. This cycle which you thought could have no break in it, self-perpetuating, is destroyed. And the important place where it's destroyed is the link between the samadhi, concentration, and seeing things as they truly are. That's the crux, that's the hub of breaking delusion and gaining enlightenment. Because of samadhi, because of the ability to sustain the awareness free of the five hindrances, you are temporarily interrupting this vicious cycle of view leading to perceptions, leading to thoughts, leading to views, leading to perceptions, leading to thoughts, and so on. There, through samadhi, through the ability to sustain the awareness without the five hindrances, you see things as they truly are. In Pali, yatha bhuta jnana dasana. You see things not as perception and thought cause you to, because those things are quiet. You see things as they truly are. Not by being involved in it, by being outside of it, outside of that cycle. And when you see things as they truly are, the illusion is broken through. It is that point, that crux of samadhi and yathābhūta jnana dasana, of samatha and insight, of sustaining your attention, being cool, being quiet, being peaceful, giving rise to actually seeing, this is my body, this is my mind, this is will, this is its core, this is craving. This is the result of craving. And the dependent origination goes into its transcendental mode and it ends the process. The process has always been an empty process, not a being in there calling the shots, but causes and results, sometimes very complex causes and results. Sometimes those causes occurring outside of you, as with hearing the teaching of a Buddha. But those causes produce results, and there comes a time in this process, this empty process, which we call the body and the mind, the five khandhas, where the chaitanya, the will, becomes conditioned to, in effect, destroy itself. The will sees that tranquility is the highest happiness, becomes repelled from disturbances, afflictions, and thereby naturally, whether you choose to or not, is not the point, because there's no one there doing the choosing, just veers towards cessation, leans towards it, goes towards it, and all the time you are just a passenger on this journey. Chaitanya still occurs. What before was a mirage of you doing something becomes seen as just the natural process, part of the mind. The will occurs, it arises and passes away. Choice happens, but it's not you doing the choosing. That's why someone once asked me some years ago, well, if there's no one in there, if this is all conditional, why even bother to meditate? Why put it in this, all this effort? You got no choice. It just happens. It just appears that a choice is being made. That which we thought of as a will originating from itself is seen in its true life as will arising from craving. And eventually it just burns itself out. And that's what happens with the path, happening in the cycle of existence from time immemorial. People going around and around samsara, and then there comes a point where they stop. Now that's my explanation as best I can this evening of dependent origination. There's obviously many points which I've missed out. It's a very complicated teaching of Buddhism. Have you got any questions? Yeah.
I can accept what you say in a certain way, but I've had various experiences, and one was how I became a Buddhist, and I was quite happy doing something else, and suddenly it seemed as if a giant hand had picked me up and turned me around and put me in a different place when I was doing this instead, and I've had the same experience previously. I've also had the experience where if I really needed something, I got it. And I've also had the experience that things work out for the best in the end. And that seems to give the lie to the idea that there's no one in the driver's seat. It seems to indicate that some benevolent being is directing me.
You're asking about the existence of a benevolent being, because it seems to be that whenever you need something, something happens. That even like coming to the Buddhism and meditation retreat, it's this, like, you know, as you, in your words, a big hand dragged you out from what you were doing before and placed you in here. If you look closely at that, it is that there is a reality there. There is like a movement towards the meditation retreat or towards Buddhism, and things sometimes work out as you want them, sometimes they don't. If the view is there from the past of a benevolent being, then most of us have come from the Christian conditioning, from the Western conditioning, which we've been taught, assumed a benevolent being from the very beginning. Because of that view, that we will perceive these occurrences in the way that we explain them as happening from a benevolent being. That instead of looking at the movement, the leaning towards, say, doing some meditation as possibly coming from a past life, or coming from just that which we call wisdom. Sometimes we can call it as coming from a being, a divine being. And sometimes we can call those fortunate experiences which happen in our life, we can take those as coming from like a divine being. And all the faults, all the mistakes, as either coming from our own stupidity or from some sort of devil. It's like the person, the story, I can't resist this, I'm in that funny mood, of the Catholic priest, the Anglican priest, and the Jewish rabbi, who in an ecumenical meeting were discussing actually how they divide their donations after a religious meeting. And the Catholic priest said, well, I just put them on the table, and you know, like half for the church and half for me. And the Anglican said, oh, that's very good. What I do is sort of one for the church, two for me. Three for the church, four for me. And the Jew said, oh, I don't do that. Very easy. I throw it all into the air, and what God wants, he takes. and he leaves the rest for me. So if you have a view of a God, then you can think that even throwing it in the air, you know, then he just leaves the rest for me. It's his will. So like sometimes like the view of a God can influence one's perception. You may have gone over in places in Asia. I remember going over in Kashmir, I think it was the first time, it was about 25 years ago. And this crazy bus driver, a Muslim, just in these dirt roads with these, you know, vertical drops going way, way down into these ravines on the foothills of the Himalayas. They're going over from Jammu into Kashmir. That, you know, he was just racing around these corners, and you'd ask him to stop, and you keep on saying, if it's Allah's will, we go over, it's Allah's will. And me saying, I'm a Buddhist, I don't believe in Allah, didn't really help at all. And so, you know, his perception was that if he went over, it wasn't his fault, it was Allah's fault. However, you know, anyone would know that if he went over, it's because he's stupid driving. So, you know, your perception, you can explain things as your fortune coming from some benevolent being and misfortune coming from, you know, some sort of fault, or you're not doing the right thing, you know, by the benevolent being. So how many times do people get afraid when, you know, Christian church or the Muslim church produces fear, that if you don't sort of pray or you don't go to church or whatever, all terrible things will happen to you. Then you ascribe all those unpleasant experiences which happened to you because of the work of a benevolent being is trying to punish you. And everything which is fortunate is the benevolent being is trying to look after you. Instead of looking at that, looking at it as impersonal causes, karma, or natural causes. The reason you came here is because of karma, aspirations. The reason good things happen to you is karma, and the bad things happen to you is karma. So does that make any sense? Here we go. Yes.
I think that if you've got you want to do that, then you've got a logically wholesome reason for that. When I got married, I was very worried. I was going to cheat on my wife. And this was a really.
Shall I turn off the tape?
It really plagued me because I knew what had happened if I did. Because when I get a conscience, I can't resist it. So I go through a very bad time with that conscience. I knew what was going to happen. Anyway, I started meditation on my body.
Here you're just giving, just for the tape, giving an example of an aspect in your life when one gave that commitment to married life, to being afraid that one may not be able to keep that commitment because of being attracted to other members of the opposite sex other than your wife, and eventually you manage to keep that commitment. And the point is, when we look upon this dependent origination, you ask why, where did that come from? Was it actually God helping you, or was it you doing it? Or can you instead ascribe this to like just the cause of relationships? Because of, instead of like beings, look upon the fear of wrongdoing, the realization of wrongdoing being a cause of dukkha. And that being the inspiration, that being the incitement, to change the way you allow the mind to work, to restrain the eyes and the activities, so you never got in those situations. And after a while, you can see that all these can be ascribed to impersonal forces, a one cause giving rise to a result, which itself is the cause for the next result. Just the simile of just a candle sort of on the altar. Just the flame is not the same from one moment to the next. There's all that causal connection between one moment of the flame to the next moment of the flame to the next moment of the flame. And reasons without thinking that there is someone actually doing that flame. The television, for the child who thinks there must be these little people inside acting and changing the costumes all the time. Or the radio, as if there's a person inside there speaking. Who can also play the violin and all sorts of things. It's like a little being in the machine there, which we think is there. And instead of ascribing this thing we call will, activity towards a being, you can very easily look upon it as just the cause of relationships, of mental activities. Something in the mind occurring, and that gives rise to something else happening afterwards. And you can see that continuum of cause and effect, as you meditate. And you can see that is actually what's happening. And ascribing that to a being is just a delusion. on.
The question of original cause. In the sense that God is said to be a transcendent being beyond this process that we're caught up in, the original cause of the process. And I can't see how it would be a problem having such a notion as long as there wasn't a tendency to get it, to get caught up in it, in the sense that the work to be done, it's got nothing to do with the notion of original causes, or it's simply to observe the process. So as long as it's there, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I'm just trying to remember it for the tape, so make it a simple question.
Well, it's kind of important whether there's a God or isn't a God. The work is still the process of letting go, and that's where the emphasis has to be.
In a sense, yes. It's, well, in a sense, you're asking, I've got to repeat this for the tape, because otherwise when people hear this tape, they get this great silence, and then they get my answer, and they're not quite sure. I spend all the time trying to work out what the question is, so this is the answer. So the question is that that many people posit a transcendent God, which is outside of the universe, the world, outside of time.
Original cause.
Yeah, as the original cause, and that such an idea doesn't really interfere with actually the process of having to let go and so forth. Actually, that if one really looks very carefully at that very idea of a transcendent God, who's outside of time and outside of space, you can start to look at it in this way, and it's a very powerful way which scraps the whole idea that if it's a being, it has to do something. It has to be active. That's why a being is different than a lump of wood. This is a Buddhist simile. A lump of wood just sits there. It doesn't do anything. That's why it's not called a being. Or like a brick in the wall. It doesn't act. It doesn't create. It doesn't interfere. If something doesn't act, interfere, do something, you can't really call it being. Being is doing. Some philosopher said that, because I remember one of the other jokes, that some philosopher said being is doing. No, it wasn't that. They said to be is to do. I think it was Sartre said to do is to be.
And
I haven't finished my joke yet. I think it was Descartes said, to do is to be, and Sartre said, to be is to do, and to finish off, that Frank Sinatra said, dooby dooby doo. Anyway, a great philosopher. But the point is that a being has to do something. Now, as far as the transcendental God is concerned, that by intrinsic nature, if it's a being, it has to keep on doing. It's not enough just to be a being who just pushes a button, sets the universe, and then just disappears. And like theology recognizes that the role of God, its function in all theistic religions, is twofold. To create, and then to keep on interfering in the creation. It can't keep its fingers out of what it started. And it has to do that, because otherwise the God as a being would become meaningless. If it doesn't do anything, it's tantamount to not being a being, to not existing.
The Buddha keeps on interfering with the process through eternity. He keeps on banging with the appearances for some reason or other.
It's not the same Buddha. There's different processes. As you say, the Buddha keeps on interfering. No, I mean, it's different processes coming to that particular stage. It's not just an ordinary meteor which hits the earth and goes out of it in a blaze like an ordinary arahat. This is a really huge blaze, a big meteor. But just like a meteor, just the same simile. the process of five khandhas, which eventually goes out in a huge blaze. However, the idea that a transcendental God can somehow not do, not act, is tantamount to saying that that does not exist. If it doesn't do, it has no purpose. And it has no purpose, it doesn't exist.
Right, just is.
Just is means you won't be able to see it if it doesn't move. It won't tantamount to not being there. The same as being as not being. Because a thing, to understand a thing, it's not just understanding what it is, but what it does. It's important. Its function, as well as its composition.
I don't know if I agree with that.
You argue with God about it. But it's interesting, because that's the same thing about the self. It's interesting that the only religion which denies a God is a religion which denies the self. And you will find that the two have to go together, because it understands that just as a self, a soul has a function, it does something, or it appears to do something, you find that that which we think is doing is just a natural process, impersonal process. You get rid of the idea of a self, a soul, in the same way you get rid of the idea of a God. And that inquiry actually has profound implications. Because if there is a God, it has to do something. If it does something, it can create the universe, it can interfere with it. And that's why that people pray to that. Please interfere. I want to be rich, I want to be happy. It's a self-consistent system, which can only be broken by actually seeing the fallacy of the self, the fallacy of a God. It just doesn't work. But don't stop at just saying a God is. If anyone, you know, asks, you know, when you were a child, you asked, you know, what is God? And where is he? The important question is, what does God do? And that's a question which you should ask. What's his purpose? Because a being is very often defined by what it does.
If it's a higher order, transcending reality, it might be beyond the human possibility and comprehension.
You're asking that, like, it's transcendent, it's beyond human comprehension. What's beyond human comprehension? You usually find is a cop-out. It's like a scam. I can't explain it. People say, if it can't be explained, then it's tantamount to saying it doesn't exist. So it's being quite firm. And if nirvana, enlightenment, cannot be explained, you can just forget about it. If existence can't be explained, forget about it. If a thing is, it has a purpose, it has attributes, and if you can't find out, define, explain those attributes, it's a sign that the thing is just an illusion. It doesn't really exist. It's like the Loch Ness Monster. Now, who's seen it? Who's seen it? Who's seen it? Who can describe what it is? People say, you know, it's just indescribable, the Loch Ness Monster, just believe me. Have you seen it? Has anyone seen it? Who can describe it? When you find out there's no one in the whole world can describe it, because that's all transcendental. It's tantamount to say it's not there. Anyway, there you go. That's all, Angel.
I have another question. My friend, the Buddha's Unitarian and the relationship with the God. The Buddha doesn't create or destroy, he doesn't punish or reward, he simply explains.
That's true, yes. the Buddha doesn't create or destroy, doesn't punish or reward. The Buddha just points the way, in his words, and it's up to each individual to follow or not follow as they feel appropriate, as their karma allows them. And that's true. And the Buddha is very different from the idea of a god. As one person once said, if God had created the world, he'd have committed suicide by now when he saw what state it was in.
So the Buddha has the time to explain.
I shouldn't say that in here, should I? To get one of my own.
So the Buddha has the functions to explain that he's not there, he doesn't exist.
So, the Buddha was a process, a past canvas, the process, and it's the function of that process in that final stage, which is now called Buddhahood, to teach the Dhamma. That's the whole reason why it keeps going after enlightenment till final death, to point the way. After the Parinibbana, when the Buddha doesn't do anything, he doesn't exist. Gone, poof, disappeared. Yeah, come on.
My framework for God is that it's imminent entrance and that it is the cosmos itself and that it interpenetrates all things, and what it does is it lives. But that doesn't clash with the Buddha's teachings to me. The Buddha's message to humanity was to help people to move to another stage of existence.
Well, not quite. It's the Buddha's message is not to move to another stage of existence. It is just to stop all this existing business.
Yes, I can see that it's simply because we're here in this world and we have to concentrate on our experience here. We can't concentrate on things we can't experience. Therefore, the teachings relate to this world. And they don't dwell on things in other worlds because we can't experience those things. But that, to me, doesn't imply those worlds aren't there.
Oh, indeed, there are other worlds, but each of those worlds can be experienced here and now, which is the important thing about the Buddha's teachings, that when we chant in the morning and evening, a part of the chanting is that the Dhamma, the teachings of the Buddha, are the Sanditika, which are their here and now teachings. They can be experienced, every wise person for themselves. And you can experience all the different realms of existence, as I was mentioning earlier. If you can get into the jhanas, you experience many of the heaven realms. You know what they're like. And by that experience, you know that if the mind dies in this stage, that's where it will stay. You can see all of this. There's no very clearly. It's an experiential teaching. You can also experience very clearly that this, which we call a body and mind, is no one there. It is an empty state. This is an experience. It's not something we just believe or infer. And even like the existence of a god, if there's no being inside you, and you see all these other conglomerations of what we call five khandhas, all these processes sitting here, you realize that that's not a being either. There is no beings in this world. That is the illusion. However, the illusion of a self, which we hold on to inside, creates not the illusion of one self, but many selves. And also illusion of an ultimate self, an ultimate being, which is, you know, the God. But if you break down the illusion of self, at the same time you'll completely destroy any possibility of a god. And it's also important to, when you have like ideas, you what it is because of the desire born of delusion. Remember I saying that the delusion creates craving. It's the craving is that which bends perception to fit the views. You bend thought to support your views, and you know, you'll think and you'll perceive, you choose what you think, you choose your perceptions to support your views. Just like as in the science labs, you know, when you've got like a view of what you're